This is Audible.
Look Who's Back by Timur Vermish. Read by Julian Rind-Tutt. Awakening in Germany. It was probably the German people, the folk, which surprised me most of all. I really did everything humanly possible to destroy the foundations for a future existence on this soil. This soil which the enemy had desecrated. Bridges, power stations, roads, railways. I gave instructions for every last one to be obliterated. I have since checked when this order was issued. It was in March, and I believe I had made myself perfectly clear. All supply facilities were to be razed, waterworks, telephone systems, resources, factories, workshops, farms, all material assets, everything. And by that I did mean absolutely everything. These matters must be approached with care and precision. A directive such as this can leave no room for doubt. For we all know of the ordinary soldier at the front who, contained within his own particular sector, understandably lacks an overview of the general situation, knowledge of the strategic, tactical necessities. The soldier who comes and says, "Do I really have to set light to this, let's say, kiosk, too? Can't we let it fall into enemy hands? Is it really so bad if the kiosk falls into enemy hands?" Bad? Of course it's bad. The enemy reads newspapers too, doesn't he? He will use the kiosk to conduct business. He will turn the kiosk against us. Everything he finds will be turned against us. Every material asset, let me underline this once more, every single material asset must be destroyed. Not just houses, but doors too. And door handles. Then the screws, and not only the long ones. The screws must be unscrewed and then ruthlessly bent out of shape. The doors must be ground into sawdust and then burned to cinders. Else the enemy will show no mercy. He will walk in and out of these doors as it pleases him. But present him with a broken door handle, bent screws and a heap of ashes. Well, Mr. Churchill, be my guest. At all events, these requirements are the brutal consequence of war. Of this I have always been aware. And thus the instructions I gave could not have been worded differently, even though the background to my directive was different. To begin with, at any rate. It could no longer be denied that the German Volk had ultimately proved itself inferior in the epic struggle against the English, against Bolshevism, against imperialism. Thereby, and I will not mince my words, forfeiting its future existence, even at the most primitive level as hunter-gatherers. Accordingly, it lost its right to waterworks, bridges, and roads, and door handles too. This is the reason I issued my directive. It must be said that I also did it in part for the sake of thoroughness, for when I took the odd stroll outside the Reich Chancellery, I had to concede that, with their flying fortresses, the Americans and the English had already relieved us of a substantial volume of the work. Naturally, after the directive was issued, I did not monitor in every minute detail how it was executed. The reader will appreciate how much else I had to do, grappling with the Americans in the West, resisting the Russians in the East, planning the development of the world's capital city, Germania. In my opinion, the Wehrmacht should have been able to cope with any remaining door handles. And this Volk should no longer exist. As I have now established, however, it is still here, a fact I find rather difficult to comprehend. On the other hand, I am here too, and I cannot understand that either. Chapter 1. I remember waking up. It must have been early afternoon. Opening my eyes, I saw above me the sky, which was blue, with the occasional cloud. It felt warm, and I sensed at once that it was too warm for April. One might almost call it hot. It was relatively quiet. I could not see any enemy aircraft flying overhead, or hear the thunder of artillery fire. There seemed to be no shelling nearby, or explosions, no air raid sirens. It also struck me that there was no Reich Chancellery and no Führerbunker. I turned my head and saw that I was lying on an area of undeveloped land, surrounded by terraces of houses. Here and there, urchins had daubed the brick walls with paint, which aroused my ire, and I took the snap decision to summon Grand Admiral Dönitz. Still half asleep, I imagined that Dönitz must also be lying around here somewhere. But then discipline and logic triumphed, and in a flash I grasped the peculiarity of the situation in which I found myself. I do not usually camp out. My first thought was, what did I get up to last night? Seeing as I do not drink, I could rule out any overindulgence in alcohol. The last thing I recalled was sitting on a sofa, a divan, with Eva. I also remembered that I was, or we were, feeling rather carefree. Just for once I had decided to put the affairs of state to one side. We had no plans for the evening. Naturally, there was no question of going out to a restaurant or to the pictures. Entertainment in the capital was gratifyingly thin on the ground, largely as a result of my directive. How could I be sure that Stalin would not be arriving in the city in the coming days? At that point in the war, such a turn of events could not be dismissed out of hand. What was absolutely certain was that he would be as unlikely to find a picture house here as he would in Stalingrad. I think Eva and I chatted for a while, and I showed her my old pistol. But when I awoke, I was unable to recall any further details. Not least on account of the bad headache I was suffering from. No, my attempts to piece together the events of the previous evening were leading nowhere. I thus decided to take matters into my own hands and get to grips with my situation. Over the course of my life, I have learned to observe, to reflect, to pick up on even the smallest detail to which many learned people pay scant heed or simply ignore. Thanks to years of iron discipline, I can say with a clear conscience that in a crisis I become more composed, more level-headed. My senses are sharpened. I work calmly, with precision, like a machine. Methodically, I synthesize the information at my disposal. I am lying on the ground. I look around. Litter is strewn beside me. I can see weeds and grass, the odd bush, a daisy and a dandelion. I can hear voices shouting. They cannot be far away. The noise of a ball bouncing repeatedly on the ground. I look in the direction of these sounds. They are coming from a group of lads playing association football. Not little boys anymore, but probably too young for the Volksturm. I expect they are in the Hitler Youth, although evidently not on duty. For the time being, the enemy appears to have ceased its onslaught. A bird is hopping about in the boughs of a tree. It tweets, it sings. Most people will simply interpret such behavior as a sign of happiness. But in this uncertain situation, the expert on the natural world and the day-to-day battle for survival exploits every scrap of information, however small, and infers that no predators are present. Right beside my head is a puddle, which appears to be shrinking. It must have rained, but some time ago now. At the edge of the puddle is my peaked cap. This is how my trained mind works. This is how it worked, even then, in a moment of confusion. I sat up without difficulty. I moved my legs, hands, and fingers. I did not appear to be injured. My physical state was encouraging. But for the sore head, I was in rude health. Even the shaking, which usually afflicted my hand, seemed to have subsided. Glancing down, I saw myself dressed in full military uniform. My jacket had been soiled, but not excessively so, which ruled out the possibility of my having been buried alive. I could identify mud stains and what looked like bread or cake crumbs or similar. The fabric reeked of fuel, petrol, perhaps. Eva may have used too much solvent to clean my uniform. It smelled as if she had emptied a whole jerry can of the stuff over me. Eva was not to be seen, nor did any of my staff appear to be in the immediate vicinity. As I was brushing the most conspicuous specks of dirt from the front of my coat and sleeves, I heard a voice.
"Hey, guys, check this out. Woo, major casualty."
I seemed to have given the impression that I needed help, and this was admirably recognised by the three Hitler youths. Even though they were off the mark with my rank, they stopped their game and approached me respectfully. Understandably so, to find oneself all of a sudden face to face with the Führer of the German Reich amongst daisies and dandelions on a patch of wasteland generally used for sport and physical training is an unusual turn of events in the daily routine of a young man yet to reach full maturity. Nonetheless, the small troop hurried over like greyhounds, eager to help. The youth is the future. The boys gathered around me, but kept a certain distance. After affording me a cursory inspection, the tallest of the youths, clearly the troop leader, said, "You all right, boss?" Despite my apprehension, I could not help noticing that the Nazi salute was missing altogether. I acknowledge that his casual form of address, mixing up boss and Führer, may have been a consequence of the surprise factor. In a less confusing situation, it might have been unintentionally comic. After all, had not the most farcical events occurred in the unremitting storm of steel of the trenches? Even in unusual situations, however, the soldier must have certain automatic responses. This is the point of drill. If soldiers lack these automatic responses, then the army is worthless. I stood up, which was not easy, as I must have been lying there for a while. But I straightened out my jacket and attempted a makeshift dusting of my trousers with a few gentle slaps. Then I cleared my throat and asked the troop leader, "Where's Bormann?"
"Oh?"
Unbelievable.
"Bormann! Martin!
Don't know who you're on about."
"Never heard of him."
"What's he look like?"
"Like a Reichsleiter, for pity's sake." Something was very amiss. I was obviously still in Berlin, but I appeared to have been deprived of the entire apparatus of government. I had to get back to the Führerbunker, urgently, and it was as clear as daylight that the youths around me were not going to be a great deal of help here. The first thing I needed to do was orient myself. The featureless piece of land where I now stood could have been anywhere in the city. I had to get to a street. In this protracted ceasefire, surely there would be enough passers-by, workers and motor cab drivers, to point me in the right direction. I expect my needs did not appear sufficiently pressing to the Hitler youths, who looked as if they wanted to resume their game of association football. The tallest of the lads now turned to his friends, allowing me to read his name, which his mother had sewn onto a brightly coloured jersey. "Hitler Youth Ronaldo, which way to the street?" The reaction was feeble. I am afraid to say that the youths practically ignored me, although as he shuffled past, one of the two younger ones pointed limply to a corner of the wasteland. Peering more closely, I could see that there was indeed a thoroughfare in that direction. I made a mental note to have Rust dismissed. The man had been Reich Minister for Education since 1934, and there is no place for such abysmal sloppiness in education. How is a young soldier supposed to find the victorious path to Moscow, to the very heart of Bolshevism, if he cannot even recognize his own supreme commander? I bent down, picked up my cap, and, putting it on, walked steadily and purposefully in the direction the boy had indicated. I went around a corner and made my way between high walls down a narrow alleyway towards the brightness of the street. A timid and bedraggled cat with a coat of many hues sloped past me along the wall. I took four or five more steps and then emerged into the street. The violent onslaught of light and colour took my breath away. The last time I had seen it, I remembered the city being terribly dusty and a kind of field grey, with heaps of rubble and widespread damage. What lay before me now was quite different. The rubble had vanished, or at least had been removed, the streets cleared. Instead, there were numerous, nay, innumerable, brightly coloured vehicles on either side of the street. They may well have been automobiles, but were smaller, and yet they looked so technically advanced as to make one suspect that the Messerschmitt plant must have had a leading hand in their design. The houses were freshly painted in a variety of colours, reminding me of the confectionery of my youth. I admit, I began to feel faintly dizzy. My eyes sought something familiar. and on the far side of the carriageway I spied a shabby park bench on a strip of grass. I ventured a few steps, and I'm not ashamed to say that they may have seemed quite tentative. I heard the ring of a bell, the screeching of rubber on asphalt, and then somebody screamed at me.
Oi! What's your game? Are you blind or what?
I'm terribly sorry, I heard myself say, both shaken and relieved. Beside me was a bicyclist. This, at least, was an image I was comparatively familiar with. Added to that, the man was wearing a protective helmet, which appeared to have sustained some serious damage given the number of holes in it. So, we were still at war.
What the hell do you think you're doing, staggering around like that?
Pardon me, I need to sit down.
I suggest you take a lie down, pal, and make it a nice long one.
I found sanctuary on the park bench. I expect I was somewhat pale when I slumped onto it. This young man did not seem to have recognized me either. Again, there was no Nazi salute. From his reaction, one would have thought he had almost collided with any old passerby, a nobody. And this negligence seemed to be common practice. An elderly gentleman walked past me, shaking his head, followed by a hefty woman pushing a futuristic perambulator. Likewise, a familiar object, but it offered no help out of my desperate situation. I stood up and approached her with as much outward confidence as I could muster. Excuse me. Now, this may come as something of a surprise, but I urgently need to find my way to the Reich Chancellery.
Are you on the Stefan Raab show?
I'm sorry?
Or Kirkeling? Harald Schmidt?
It may have been nervousness which triggered my impatience. I grabbed her by the arm.
Pull yourself together, woman. As a fellow German, you have your duties and obligations. We are at war. What do you think the Russians would do to you if they got here? Do you honestly think a Russian would glance at your child and say, "Well, what a fine young German girl we have here, but for the child's sake, I will leave my baser urges in my trousers"? At this very hour, on this very day, the future of the German Volk, the purity of German blood, indeed the survival of humanity itself, is at stake. Do you wish to be responsible for the end of civilization merely because, in your extraordinary stupidity, you are unwilling to show the Führer of the German Reich the way to his Reich Chancellery?
The lack of a helpful response had almost ceased to be a surprise. This imbecilic woman shook her sleeve from my grasp, glared at me dumbfounded, and tapped the side of her head with her index finger, an unequivocal gesture of disapproval. I had to accept the truth of the matter. Something here had spiraled completely out of control. I was no longer being treated like a commander-in-chief, like a Reichsführer. The footballers, the elderly gentleman, the bicyclist, the perambulator woman, this was no coincidence. My first instinct was to notify the security agencies to restore order, but I curbed this instinct. I had insufficient knowledge of my circumstances. I needed more information. With ice-cool composure, my methodical brain, now functioning again, recapped the situation. I was in Germany. I was in Berlin, even though the city looked wholly unfamiliar to me. This Germany was different, but some of its aspects reminded me of the Reich I was familiar with. Bicyclists still existed, as did automobiles, so probably newspapers still existed too. I looked around, and under my bench I did find something resembling a newspaper, albeit printed far more lavishly. The paper was in colour, something new to me. It was called Media Market. For the life of me, I could not recall having given my approval to such a publication, nor would I ever have approved it. The information it contained was totally incomprehensible. Anger swelled within me. How, at a time of paper shortage, could the German folk's valuable resources be squandered on such mindless rubbish? As soon as I got back to my desk, Funk was going to get a proper dressing down. But at that moment, I needed some reliable news. A Völkischer Beobachter, a Stürmer. Why, I'd have settled for the local Panzerbeer, which had only been going for a few issues. I spotted a kiosk not too far away, and even from that distance, I could make out an extraordinary array of papers. You could have been forgiven for thinking we were deep in the most indolent peacetime. I got up impatiently. Too much time had already been lost. Now, order must be restored as rapidly as possible. Surely my troops were awaiting orders. It was quite possible my presence was sorely needed elsewhere. I hurried to the kiosk. Even a cursory look furnished me with some useful information. Myriad colourful papers hung on the outside wall, in Turkish. A large number of Turks must now be living in this area. I must have been unconscious for a significant period of time, during which waves of Turks had descended on Berlin. Remarkable! After all, the Turk, essentially a loyal ally of the German folk, had persisted in remaining neutral. In spite of all our efforts, we had never been able to get him to enter the war on the side of the Axis powers. But now it seemed as if, during my absence, someone, Dönitz, I imagine, had convinced the Turk to lend us his support. Moreover, the comparatively peaceful atmosphere on the streets suggested that the deployment of Turkish forces had brought about a decisive turning point in the war. Yes. I had always harboured respect for the Turk, but would never have imagined him capable of such an achievement. On the other hand, a lack of time had precluded my having followed the development of that country in any great detail. Kemal Atatürk's reforms must have given the nation a sensational boost. This seemed to have been the miracle on which Goebbels had always pinned his hopes. Full of confidence, my heart was now pounding. My refusal to abandon faith in ultimate victory, even in the deepest, darkest hour of the Reich, had paid off. 4 or 5 Turkish-language publications, all printed in bright colours, were unmistakable proof of a new, triumphant Berlin-Ankara axis. Now that my greatest concern, my concern for the welfare of the Reich, appeared to have been assuaged in such a surprising manner, I had to find out how much time I had spent in that strange twilight on the patch of waste ground. Unable to see a Völkischer Beobachter anywhere, obviously it had sold out, I cast about for the most familiar-looking paper, which went by the name Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. It was new to me, but unlike some of the others displayed there, I was heartened by the reassuring typeface of its title. I didn't bother with any of the news reports. I was looking for the date. It said, 30th of August, 2011. I gaped at the number in amazement, in disbelief. I turned my attention to a different paper, the Berliner Zeitung, which also displayed an exemplary German typeface, and sought out the date. 2011. I tore the newspaper from its bracket, opened it, and turned a page, then another one. 2011. The number began to dance before my eyes, as if mocking me. It moved slowly to the left, then back again more quickly, swaying like a group of revellers in a beer tent. My eyes tried to follow the number, then the paper slipped from my grasp. I felt myself sinking. In vain, I tried to clutch at other newspapers on the rack. I slid to the ground. Then everything went black. Chapter 2. When I regained consciousness, I was still lying on the ground. Something damp was being pressed against my forehead.
Are you okay?
Bent over me was a man who may have been 45 or even over 50. He was wearing a checked shirt and plain trousers, a typical worker's outfit. This time I knew which question to ask first.
What is today's date?
29th of August? No, wait, it's the 30th.
Which year, man?
I croaked, sitting up. He frowned at me.
2011, he said, staring at my coat. What did you think, 1945?
I tried to come up with a fitting riposte, but thought it more prudent to get to my feet.
Maybe you should lie down a little longer,
the man said.
Or at least sit. I've got an armchair in the kiosk.
My first instinct was to tell him that I had no time to rest, but I had to acknowledge that my legs were still shaking. So I followed him into the kiosk. He sat on a chair near the vending window and stared at me.
Sip of water? How about some chocolate granola bar?
I nodded in a daze. He stood up, fetched a bottle of soda water, and poured me a glass. From a shelf, he took a colourful bar of what I took to be some sort of iron ration, wrapped in foil. He opened the wrapping, exposing something that looked like industrially pressed grain, and put it in my hand. There must still be a bread shortage.
You should have a bigger breakfast, he said, before sitting down again. Are you filming nearby?
Filming?
You know, a documentary, a film. They're always filming round here.
Film?
Goodness me, you're in a right state.
Pointing at me, he laughed.
Oh, do you always go around like this?
I looked down at myself. I didn't notice anything out of the ordinary apart from the dust and the odour of petrol.
As a matter of fact, I do, I said.
Perhaps I had suffered an injury to my face.
Do you have a mirror?
I asked.
Sure,
he said, pointing to it.
Right next to you, just above focus.
I followed his finger. The mirror had an orange frame on which was printed "The Mirror," just for good measure, as if this were not obvious enough. The bottom third of it was wedged between some magazines. I gazed into it. I was surprised by how immaculate my reflection appeared. My coat even looked as if it had been ironed. The light in the kiosk must be flattering.
"Because of the lead story?"
the man asked.
"They run those Hitler stories every 3 issues nowadays. I don't reckon you need do any more research. You're amazing."
"Thank you," I said absently.
"No, I really mean it," he said.
"I've seen Downfall 2. Bruno Ganz was superb, but he's not a patch on you. Your whole demeanour, I mean, one would almost think you were the man himself."
I glanced up.
"Which man?"
"You know, the Führer,"
he said, raising both his hands, crooking his index and middle fingers together, then twitching them up and down 2. I could hardly bring myself to accept that after 66 years, this was all that remained of the once rigid Nazi salute. It came as a devastating shock, but a sign, nonetheless, that my political influence had not vanished altogether in the intervening years. I flipped up my arm in response to his salute.
"I am the Führer."
He laughed once more.
"Incredible! You're a natural."
I could not comprehend his overpowering cheerfulness. Gradually, I pieced together the facts of my situation. If this were no dream, it had lasted too long for that, then we were indeed in the year 2011, which meant I was in a world totally new to me, and by the same token I had to accept that, for my part, I represented a new element in this world. If this world functioned according to even the most rudimentary logic, then it would expect me to be either 122 years old, or, more probably, long dead.
"Do you act in other things too?"
he said.
"Have I seen you before?"
"I do not act," I said, rather brusquely. "Of course not," he said, putting on a curiously serious expression. Then he winked at me.
"What are you in? Have you got your own program?"
"Naturally," I replied. "I've had one since 1920. As a fellow German, you are surely aware of the 25 points. He nodded enthusiastically.
"But I still don't recall seeing you anywhere. Have you got a card? Any flyers?"
"Don't talk to me about the Luftwaffe," I said sadly. "In the end, they were a complete failure." I tried to work out what my next move should be. It seemed likely that a 56-year-old Führer might meet with disbelief, even in the Reich Chancellery and Führerbunker. In fact, he was certain to. I had to buy some time, weigh up my options. I needed to find somewhere to stay. Then I realized, all too painfully, that I had not a pfennig on me. For a moment, unpleasant memories were stirred of my time in the men's hostel in 1909. It had been a vital experience, I admit, allowing me an insight into life which no university in the world could have provided. And yet that period of austerity was not one I had enjoyed. Those dark months flashed through my mind. The disdain, the contempt, the uncertainty, the worry over securing the bare essentials, the dry bread. Brooding and distracted, I bit into the foil-wrapped grain. It was surprisingly sweet. I inspected the product. "I'm rather partial to them, too," the newspaper vendor said. "Want another one?" I shook my head. Larger problems faced me now. I needed a livelihood, however modest or basic. I needed somewhere to stay, and a little money, until I had a clearer perspective. Perhaps I needed to find a job, temporarily at least, until I knew whether and how I might be able to seize the reins of government again. Until then, a means of earning money was essential. Maybe I could work as a painter, or in an architect's practice. And I was not above a bit of labouring either, not at all. Of course, the knowledge I possessed would be more beneficial for the German folk if it were put to use in a military campaign, but given my ignorance of the current situation, this was an illusory scenario. After all, I did not even know which countries the German Reich now shared a border with. I had no idea who was hostile towards us or against whom one could return fire. For now, I had to content myself with what I could achieve with my manual skills. Perhaps I could build a parade ground or a section of autobahn. "Come on, be serious for a moment." The voice of the newspaper seller rang in my ears. "Don't tell me you're still an amateur with that routine." This was the height of impertinence. "I am no amateur," I said emphatically. "I am not one of those bourgeois parasites."
"No, no,"
the man assured me. He was beginning to come across as a thoroughly honest individual at heart.
"I mean, what do you do for a living?"
What, indeed? What ought I to say?
Well, at present I am partly in retirement," I said, cautiously outlining my situation. "Don't get me wrong," he said, "but if you really haven't, well, that's incredible. I mean, they pass by here all the time. The place is teeming with agents, film types, telepeople. They're always delighted to get a tip-off, discover a new face. If you haven't got a card, how am I going to get hold of you? What's your phone number? Email? Where do you live, then?"
Now he really had hit a nerve. But the man did not appear to be attempting anything underhand, so I decided to risk it. "At present, the question of my billeting is, how should I put it, somewhat unresolved."
"Okay. So, are you staying with a girlfriend?"
I thought briefly of Eva. Where might she be? "No," I mumbled, feeling unusually disconsolate. "I have no female companion, not any longer."
"Ooh," the newspaper seller said. "Got you. It's all still a bit fresh."
"Yes," I admitted. "Everything here is really quite fresh for me."
"Wasn't really working out towards the end, eh?"
"That would be an accurate assessment of the situation," I nodded.
"Steiner's army group offensive never got off the ground."
"Inexcusable."
He looked confused.
"With your girlfriend, I mean. Who was to blame?"
"I don't know," I said. "Ultimately Churchill, I expect." He laughed, then he gave me a long, thoughtful stare. "I like your style." Then his voice changed as he growled, "I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse."
"Offer?"
"Listen, I don't know what your standards are, but if you haven't got any particular requirements, then you're welcome to spend a night or two here."
"Here?"
I looked around the kiosk. "Can you afford the Adlon?" He was right.
I looked at the floor with embarrassment. You see me virtually penniless, I conceded.
Well, then. And it's no surprise, seeing as you don't put your talent out there. You shouldn't hide.
I have not been hiding, I protested.
It was because of the relentless bombing.
Whatever, he said dismissively.
Okay. Let's say you spend a day or two here, and I'll have a word with one or two of my customers. The latest issue of Theatre Today arrived yesterday, along with one of the film magazines. One by one, they'll come and buy their copies. Maybe we can fix something up.
I'll be absolutely honest with you. The uniform is so spot on, it wouldn't even matter if you weren't much of a performer. So, I'm going to stay here.
Just for now. During the day, you'll stick around here with me. That means if anyone comes, I can introduce you to them straight away. And if no one comes, then at least I've something to make me giggle. Or have you got somewhere else to go?
No, I sighed. I mean, apart from the Führerbunker. He laughed, then he paused.
Listen, mate, you're not going to clean me out of all my stuff, are you?
I gave him a look of disgust.
Do I look like a criminal?
He looked at me.
You look like Adolf Hitler.
Exactly, I said. Chapter 3. The next few days and nights were to be a real test for me. Humiliated by my circumstances, billeted in makeshift accommodation, cheek by jowl with dubious publications, tobacco, confectionery and tinned drinks, at night bent double in a passably but not particularly clean armchair, I had to catch up on the past 66 years without arousing unfavourable attention. Whereas others would have no doubt spent hours and days fruitlessly agonizing over scientific explanations, hunting in vain for a solution to this time-travel conundrum, which was as fantastical as it was unfathomable, my trusty, methodical reasoning was well-placed to adapt itself to the prevailing circumstances. Instead of wallowing in self-pity, I accepted the facts of the new situation and focused on reconnaissance. Especially as, to anticipate events briefly, the changed conditions seemed to offer considerably more and better opportunities. It transpired that in the last 66 years, the number of Soviet soldiers on the territory of the German Reich had fallen substantially, particularly in the Greater Berlin area. The current figure was between 30 and 50 men. In a flash, I could see that this afforded the Wehrmacht a far better prospect of victory compared to the last estimate from my general staff of around 2.5 million enemy soldiers on the Eastern Front alone. I toyed, albeit momentarily, with the idea that I had been the victim of a plot, an abduction, in which the enemy's intelligence service had concocted an elaborate hoax, circumventing my iron will to prize from me key secrets. But the technological demands of creating an entirely new world, in which, after all, I could move about freely, that variation on reality was even more inconceivable than the one I found myself in, with the ability to grasp things with my hands and see with my eyes. No. I had to wage the struggle in this bizarre here and now. And the first step in any struggle is always reconnaissance. The reader will not find it hard to imagine that obtaining new, reliable information without the necessary infrastructure posed considerable difficulties. The premises were extremely inauspicious. As far as foreign affairs were concerned, I had neither military intelligence nor the foreign ministry at my disposal. With regard to domestic affairs, establishing contact with the Gestapo was, given my circumstances, no simple matter. Even undertaking a library visit seemed too hazardous for the time being. I was thus reliant on the content of numerous publications, whose trustworthiness I was, of course, unable to verify, as well as on utterances and scraps of conversation from passers-by. The newspaper seller had very kindly supplied me with a wireless set, which, on account of technological advances in the intervening years, had shrunk to unbelievably tiny proportions. But the standards of Greater German Radio had nosedived since 1940. As soon as I switched it on, I heard a hellish din, frequently interrupted by utterly incomprehensible gibberish. I continued to listen, but the content never changed. The only difference was that it began to alternate more frequently between the racket and the gibberish. I made a number of futile attempts, each lasting several minutes, to decrypt the noise issuing from this technological marvel, then switched it off in horror. I must have sat there absolutely still for a quarter of an hour, virtually paralyzed by shock, before deciding to postpone my efforts with the wireless. So I was left with the periodicals. It had never been their top priority to provide a true historical account, and I was almost certain nothing had changed on that front. An initial review, which could not, of course, provide a complete picture, pointed to the following conclusions. 1. The Turk had not come to our assistance after all. 2. In light of the 70th anniversary of Operation Barbarossa, there were numerous reports about this episode in German history painting a negative picture of the campaign. The unanimous view was that Barbarossa had not been a victory. Indeed, the whole war had ended in defeat, or so these papers said. 3. I was reported to be dead. They said I had committed suicide. In truth, I do recall having discussed this contingency, purely theoretically, with my confidants, and my memory was definitely lacking a few hours of what had been a terribly difficult time. But, in the final analysis, I only needed look at myself to see the facts. Was I dead? We all know, of course, what to make of our newspapers. The deaf man writes down what the blind man has told him, the village idiot edits it, and their colleagues in the other press houses copy it. Each story is doused afresh with the same stagnant infusion of lies, so that the splendid brew can then be served up to a clueless Volk. In this instance, however, I was prepared to be somewhat lenient. So rarely does fate intervene this strikingly in its own workings that even the smartest minds must find it difficult to comprehend, let alone the mediocre intellects serving our so-called opinion sheets. 4. My brain required the stomach of an ox to digest the other information I managed to unearth. One had to disregard the press's miscalculations on matters military, historical, political, on every topic, in fact, including economics, the result of either ignorance or malicious intent. Otherwise, faced with such reams of foolishness, a thinking person would simply go mad. 5. Or one would develop an ulcer from reading the scribblings of the syphilitic, degenerate minds within the gutter press, who, manifestly freed from all state control, were at liberty to publish the sick and profane view of the world they had dreamed up. 6. The German Reich appeared to have given way to what was called a federal republic, the leadership of which resided with a woman, federal chancellor, although men had been entrusted with this position in the past. 7. Political parties existed again, with all the infantile, counterproductive squabbling this entails. Social democracy, that ineradicable pest, was making merry mischief once more at the expense of the long-suffering German Volk. Other organizations were sponging off the wealth of the people in their own way. Amazingly, perhaps, I found little appreciation of their work, not even in the dishonest press, which otherwise seemed so benevolent. By contrast, NSDAP activity had ceased altogether. If one were to believe the view that the Reich had been defeated, it was possible the party's work had been impeded by the victorious powers. Alternatively, the organization may have been driven underground. 8. The Völkischer Beobachter was not available everywhere. At least the kiosk belonging to this vendor, patently a radical liberal, did not have it on display. In fact,
He had no German national publications for sale at all.
9.
The Reich seemed to have shrunk, despite the fact that our neighbouring states were, by and large, the same ones. Even Poland was still there, living out its artificial existence unchecked and partly on Reich territory. Now, I may be a level-headed man, but at this point I was unable to suppress my indignation. I found myself screaming out into the darkness of the kiosk. I might as well have handed them the war on a plate!
10.
The Reichsmark was no longer legal tender, even though others, probably some clueless dilettantes on the side of the victorious powers, had clearly adapted my plan to turn it into a European-wide currency. At any rate, transactions were now being carried out in an artificial currency called Euro, regarded, as one would expect, with a high level of mistrust. I could have told those responsible that this would be the case.
11.
A partial peace seemed to be in place, although the Wehrmacht was still at war. Now known as the Bundeswehr, it was in an enviable state, no doubt on account of the technological advances that had been made. If these statistics in the newspapers were to be believed, one would have to conclude that German soldiers in the field were practically invulnerable. These days casualties were few and far between. You can imagine my anguish when, with a sigh, I thought of my own tragic fate, of those bitter nights in the Führerbunker, hunched in grief as I brooded over maps in the operations room, battling a hostile world as well as destiny herself. Back then, more than 400,000 soldiers bled to death on countless fronts, and that was in January 1945 alone. With this astonishing modern outfit, there is no doubt I could have swept Eisenhower's armies into the sea and crushed Stalin's hordes in the Urals and Caucasus like insects within just a few weeks. It was one of the few truly encouraging pieces of news that I read. With this new Wehrmacht, the future conquest of Lebensraum in the north, east, south, and west appeared as bright a prospect as it had with the old one. The consequence of recent reforms introduced by a young minister who must have been of the highest caliber, but who was forced to step down following a conspiracy hatched by resentful and small-minded university professors. Little seemed to have changed since my time, when once I had hopefully submitted my designs and drawings to the Vienna Academy. Devoured by envy, mediocrities continue at every turn to obstruct the lively genius who parades his talents undeterred. They cannot stomach the fact that his brilliance easily outshines the feeble glow of their own pitiful aura. Oh well.
My new circumstances certainly needed getting used to, but with some satisfaction I was able to conclude that, for the moment at least, there was no acute danger, even though there were inconveniences. As is normal with creative minds, my recent tendency had been to work for long periods, but also to take long rests so as to preserve my habitual freshness and speed of response. The newspaper seller, however, would open up his kiosk at the crack of dawn, which meant that I, despite the fact that I frequently continued with my studies into the early hours of the morning, could not count on any restorative sleep thereafter. What made it worse was that this gentleman had an irritating need to talk in the mornings, whereas at that time of day I usually required a period of reorientation. Even on the very first morning he swept jauntily into the kiosk with the words, "So, mein Führer, how did you sleep?" Without waiting for a second, he opened his vending window and allowed a particularly bright light to dazzle the interior of the kiosk. I moaned, screwed up my tormented eyes, and endeavoured to recall where I found myself. I was not in the Führerbunker. This was as clear as the daylight flooding into my makeshift lodgings. Had we been at headquarters, I would have had the oaf court-martialed and shot there and then. This early morning terror was undermining morale. Why, it was practically sabotage. I retained my composure all the same, took on board my new situation, and reassured myself that this cretin probably had no alternative, given his livelihood.
Indeed, in his own blundering way, I expect he was even trying to do his best by me.
Time to rock and roll,
the newspaper vendor announced cryptically.
Come on, give us a hand.
He nodded towards a number of portable magazine racks and dragged one of them outside. Still exhausted, I sighed and struggled to my feet to help him. What irony. Yesterday I was repositioning the 12th Army. Today it was magazine racks. My gaze fell on the new issue of Hunting and Hounds. Some things had not changed then. Although I had never been one for hunting, on the contrary, I had always looked upon it rather critically, at that moment I was gripped by the desire to flee this unfamiliar environment and roam the countryside with a dog at my heels, observing at close proximity the comings and goings of the natural world. I snapped out of my reverie. Within a few minutes, the two of us had set up his kiosk for the day. The newspaper seller fetched two deck chairs and put them out in the sun. He invited me to sit, took a packet of cigarettes from the breast pocket of his shirt, flicked a couple through the aperture, and offered me one. "I don't smoke," I said, shaking my head. "Thanks anyway." He put a cigarette to his lips, took a lighter from his trouser pocket, and lit it. Drawing in the smoke and exhaling with great pleasure, he said, "Ah, now for a coffee. Would you like one? I've only got instant, I'm afraid." The British must still be blockading the seas. It was a problem I'd had to deal with often enough, so it was hardly a surprise that, in my absence, the new Reich leadership, whatever form it now took or whichever name it went by, continued to be vexed by this predicament and was still searching for a solution. The brave, stoic German Volk had been forced to make do with substitutes for so long. I recalled that this alternative to coffee had been known as Ersatz, and immediately I thought of the sugary grain bar which now took the place of good German bread. This unfortunate newspaper seller was embarrassed in front of his guest because the stranglehold of the British vermin allowed him to offer nothing better. It was an outright scandal. I was overcome with emotion. "It's not your fault, my good man," I assured him. "In any case, I'm not much of a coffee lover, but I would be very grateful for a glass of water." And so I spent my first morning in this strange new epoch, shoulder to shoulder with the smoking newspaper vendor, bent on analysing the population and gaining new insight from their behaviour, until such a time as my host, through the contacts he had mentioned, might be able to secure me some sort of employment. For the first couple of hours it was humble workers and pensioners who patronised the kiosk. They bought tobacco and the morning papers, but said little. A newspaper by the name of Bild seemed to be highly popular, particularly with older people. I assumed this was because the lettering was so extraordinarily large that those with poor vision would still be able to digest the news. An excellent idea, I was forced to concede, one that not even the zealous Goebbels had thought of. Just think of how much more enthusiasm it would have sparked for our cause amongst the elderly. In the last days I could remember of the war, it was chiefly the older members of the Volksturm who lacked the drive, the determination, and willingness to sacrifice themselves for the German nation. Who would have thought that a simple device such as larger lettering could have such an effect? In mitigation, there had been a paper shortage during the war, but when all is said and done, that Funk chap had been an utter moron. My presence outside the kiosk began to cause a stir. There was the occasional outburst of gaiety, especially amongst the younger workers. More often it was recognition conveyed by the words cool and epic. Totally incomprehensible, I know, but from their facial expressions I inferred a definite respect. "Isn't he great?" the newspaper seller beamed to one of his customers. "Practically no difference, is there?"
"No,"
the customer said, folding his newspaper. He was a worker, mid-twenties probably.
"But are you allowed to do that?"
"What?"
the newspaper vendor said.
"You know, the uniform and all that."
What objection could possibly be raised against the coat of a German soldier?
I asked suspiciously, a hint of irritation in my voice. The customer laughed, to silence me, I expect. He's really good. No, I mean, obviously you do this professionally, but don't you need some sort of special license to wear that in public?
Well, I never, I replied, incensed.
All I'm saying, he said, a touch intimidated, is what would the authorities think if they saw you looking like that?
This made me ponder.
His intentions were honourable, and he was right. My uniform was no longer in the best condition. It was barely presentable.
I agree. It is a bit dirty, I said, somewhat crestfallen.
But even soiled, a soldier's coat is forever nobler than the spotless dinner jacket of a fraudulent diplomat.
Why would it be forbidden? The newspaper vendor asked soberly. He's not wearing a swastika.
What the devil is that supposed to mean?
I yelled in anger.
Everyone knows damn well which party I'm in.
The customer left, shaking his head. When he was out of sight, the newspaper seller invited me to sit down again. He's got a point, he said in a friendly tone. My customers are giving you funny looks. I know you take your work seriously, but couldn't you wear something different?
Am I to deny my life, my work, my Volk?
You cannot ask that of me, I said, leaping up.
I will go on wearing this uniform until the last drop of blood has been spilled. I will not, as Brutus did to Caesar, commit a wretched act of betrayal. I will not stab in the back for a second time those who have given their lives for the movement.
You always have to get in such a lather, the vendor said, with a hint of impatience. It's not just what your uniform looks like.
What then?
It stinks, too. I don't know what it's made out of. Was it one of those boiler suits they wear at petrol stations?
In the theatre of war, the infantryman cannot change his coat, and I myself refuse to indulge in the decadence of those who live in comfort behind the front.
Whatever. But just think about your programme.
How do you mean?
Listen, you want your programme to do well, don't you?
Yes.
And? Just think about it. Someone comes by wanting to meet you, and there you are, reeking so strongly of petrol that they don't even dare light up within 10 meters.
You did,
I replied. But my words lacked their customary edge.
Reluctantly, I had to concur with his arguments.
I'm brave, you see, he laughed. Come on, why don't you pop home and fetch some more clothes?
The tiresome accommodation problem.
I told you, it's difficult at the moment. Sure, but your ex must be at work now, or out shopping. Why are you being so cagey?
You see, I said hesitantly, it's all very difficult. My home...
My logic was now in a bit of a tangle, but it was a humiliating situation, too.
Don't you have a key, or what's the problem?
This time, I couldn't help laughing at such naivety. I had no idea whether or not there was a key to the Führerbunker.
No, how should I put it? Somehow contact was, cut off.
Are you under a restraining order?
I can't even explain it to myself, I said. But it's something like that.
Heavens above, you don't give that sort of impression, he said. What on earth did you do?
I don't know, I said truthfully. I've lost all memory of the intervening period.
You don't seem like the violent type to me at any rate, he said thoughtfully.
Well, I said, running my fingers over my parting, I am a soldier, of course.
Okay, soldier, the newspaper vendor said. Let me make another suggestion, because you're ace, and because I've got faith in obsessive types like you.
Of course you have, I said, like any sensible person. We must spare no effort, indeed we must be obsessive. In the pursuit of our goals, lily-livered, two-faced compromise is the root of all evil and...
Yes, okay, he interrupted me. Now, look, tomorrow I'll bring you some of my old things. No need to thank me. I put on a bit of weight recently and can't do up the buttons anymore, but they might fit you, he said,
looking rather unhappily at his stomach.
I mean, you're not working as Goering, are you?
Why would I do that? I asked, confused. And I'll take your uniform straight to the dry cleaners.
I will not part with my uniform,
I said adamantly. As you like, he said, suddenly looking weary. You can take your uniform to the dry cleaners yourself, but you do understand, don't you, that it has to be cleaned? It was an outrage. I was being treated like a child. But I realized that nothing would change as long as I went around looking as grubby as a child. So I nodded. The shoes might be a problem, though, he said. What size are you?
43.
Mine will be too small, then, he said. But I'll come up with something. Chapter 4. The reader must be shown some sympathy if, at this or any other point, he is flabbergasted by the speed with which I adapted to my new circumstances. How can the poor reader, who during the years...